star cruising altitude, it's time for the Flyover View.
Welcome back to Flyover View, a member of the Heartland Pod family of podcasts, and a look at Heartland news from 30,000 feet. From the Gateway Arch to the Rocky Mountains, I'm your host, Kevin Smith. Now, I want to thank you for joining me today as we dive into the stories most impactful to you. So, folks, let's get this party started. Quick as a fearful Susan Collins rushes to her phone to phone 911 over the overt threat of chalk on the sidewalk. Texas DAs signal refusal to prosecute women if Roe is overturned. Travis County, Texas District Attorney Jose Garza reacted to the leak of a draft Supreme Court opinion overturning Roe v. Wade with the announcement that his office would not prosecute women for their health care choices. In Travis County, we know our community is safer when women and families can make personal health care and reproductive decisions without interference from the state, says Garza, whose jurisdiction includes Austin and the surrounding communities. I promise to continue fighting for the rights of women and to use my discretion to keep families safe. That's a consequential statement in Texas, where a so-called trigger law would outlaw abortion in the state if and when the high court's majority of right-wing judicial activists overturns the almost five decades of judicial precedent. And Garza is not alone. The chief prosecutors in five of the state's largest counties have signaled that their offices will not criminalize or prosecute personal health care decisions. The prosecutors argued even before the leak of the draft opinion that using the criminal legal system and interpretation of murder that has no grounding in the law to punish women and leveraging confidential medical information and eroding vitally important medical provider-patient relationships in doing so is beyond the pale and will have devastating consequences. Women will be afraid to seek medical treatment even if they are dying. We cannot condone such cruelty or this distorted use of our criminal legal system, and we promise to continue fighting for the rights of women in this state and elsewhere and using our discretion as prosecutors to avoid these tragic results. That statement was issued in mid-April when murder charges were brought against a South Texas woman who allegedly told staff at a Starr County hospital that she miscarried after she had attempted to induce her own abortion. The local prosecutor ultimately dropped the criminal charge, which was based on a non-existent law. But the news sent shockwaves through legal circles in Texas, where draconian anti-abortion laws are already on the books. The response of the Texas District Attorneys is part of a national pushback by elected prosecutors against the efforts to put them in positions to enforce laws that deny pregnant people control over their own bodies. After news of the leak was reported, state attorney general and local prosecutors across the state signaled that they would not prosecute patients and providers. Many of the prosecutors who have been speaking out come from liberal states, where it is unlikely that abortion will be banned. But there are some from southern states where bans are expected, including Sherry Boston from DeKalb County, Georgia, Danny Carr from Jefferson County, Alabama, and Jody Owens from Hinds County, Mississippi. And that is certainly the case for the prosecutors in Texas, the nation's second most populous state and a jurisdiction that has seen the enactment of some of the strictest anti-abortion laws in the country. Texas Republicans last year approved legislation to ban abortions after the sixth week of pregnancy, before many even know they are pregnant. That law included a radical provision that permitted private citizens to enforce the ban. Since the Supreme Court leak, Texas Governor Greg Abbott, Attorney General Ken Paxton, and the GOP legislative leaders have signaled that they are prepared to implement the most draconian bans the courts will allow. Top Republicans are already threatening to pass new legislation that would limit the discretion of prosecutors when it comes to abortion-related cases. Texas State Representative Briscoe Kane, a Republican from suburban Houston, said he plans to introduce a measure permitting Republican district attorneys from conservative counties to prosecute what he refers to as abortion crimes in counties where the local district attorney fails or refuses to do so. When the Texas Tribune reported on Kane's scheme, Travis County DA Garza pushed back, saying, "All I can say is that the courts and the state constitution have been very clear that elected district attorneys have sole criminal jurisdiction in their community. That principle, long established in the law, could prove to be critical in the fight to protect abortion rights in Texas and states across the country." Three measures to legalize recreational marijuana in Missouri, but only one seems more likely to succeed. Almost 182,000 Missourians have a medical cannabis card, and recreational cannabis could soon be on the horizon. Three measures that would legalize adult-use cannabis had a chance of moving forward this year, but only one seems likely to see the light of day. That's Legal Missouri 2022, a ballot initiative that garnered around 390,000 signatures to let voters decide on the issue in the November elections. Like the medicinal program, this one would create a constitutional amendment. The group needs at least 180,000 signatures from six of the eight state congressional districts. We turned in more than double of that, So we're very confident that even with a lot of those being invalid, we're going to be on the ballot this year, says John Payne, the campaign manager with Legal Mo 2022. A few takeaways from the measure. Legalizing, using, buying, and growing cannabis for people 21 years or older, automatically expunging the records of people with nonviolent cannabis offenses. The exception is, if you had more than 3 pounds, you would have to serve out your sentence and your probation before your record is expunged. It guarantees most licenses to businesses already in the medicinal program, with the rest going to micro-businesses through the lottery process. This is going to raise tens of millions of dollars for state and local governments, says Payne, about $50 million for the state, another $12 to $13 million for local governments. It would impose a 6% sales tax on cannabis sales, according to the campaign site. The revenue would go toward paying for expungements, drug addiction programs, the public defender system, and veteran services. There are cannabis advocates who are against Legal Mo 22, however. It doesn't end prohibition. It doesn't take it off the drug schedule, says Tim Galeo, leader of the Missouri Marijuana Legalization Movement. Galeo and many other like-minded activists support House Bill 2704, or the Cannabis Freedom Act, which we've spoken about on this podcast a few times. They say it would foster a free market. It's different than Legal Mo 22 in that it's not a constitutional amendment. The Cannabis Freedom Act would remove cannabis from the list of controlled substances. It would also expunge nonviolent offenders' records, regardless of the amount of cannabis they had. Payne said that while Legal Mo 22 doesn't go as far as removing cannabis from the drug schedule, the constitutional amendment will supersede drug scheduling statutes. I think we're effectively mooting those provisions that call cannabis a controlled substance in the state of Missouri, says Payne. Payne said their campaign thought it was highly unlikely that the legislation would act on anything, which is why they decided to take the route of the voters changing the state constitution. Galeo and his activists say a constitutional amendment is problematic because it's permanent and it takes a lot of money, money that grassroots organizations like his don't often have access to change things about that. They point to issues following the state's medicinal program rollout and the outcry from many prospective business owners who were denied a license, over 800 lawsuits for the medical program through the Department of Health and Senior Services. Payne says it's the opposite. Our amendment also includes an additional 144 licenses for social equity applicants. That's really targeted towards people in groups that have been historically arrested or prosecuted at higher rates for marijuana offenses. Cannabis Freedom Act originally started out with a no-interest loans for minority and women-owned business owners, championed by Representative Ashley Bland Manlove, a Democrat from Kansas City. That provision was removed altogether in an amendment. Opponents use their power to stall the bill at every step. It should also be noted that it takes an average of 7 years for a bill to pass and be signed into law. I really hope the petition that has submitted signatures is unsuccessful because it blocks access to investment and equity. It also only expunges a fraction of the people affected by predatory public safety policies. I'm excited to see what happens for the bill next session. The Cannabis Freedom Act bill got some traction in the House, but with only a few days left of the Missouri legislative session, moving the Senate is unlikely. The bill sponsor, Representative Ron Hicks, has said that the bill is essentially dead. A similar measure, House Joint Resolution 83, was recently voted out of a special committee. It would also put the issue on the ballot, but, like 2704, it may not go anywhere this year. Proponents of the Cannabis Freedom Act say that they'll call on Missouri Governor Mike Parson to hold a special session if Legal Mo 22 advances in August. Students recognized for ending food desert in Oklahoma City's east side. 16 young Oklahomans proved that age has nothing to do with one's ability to leave a legacy. The Urban Farm student interns from the nonprofit Restore OKC recently received recognition for their input and creative vision for a grocery store in northeast Oklahoma City. The Oklahoma Hall of Fame recently awarded the Lee Allen Smith Legacy Award to the 16 young people, along with the organization's executive director, Kaylee Dodson. Jenny Moore Campbell, Oklahoma Hall of Fame vice president, said the award would be different this year because it was being given to a group of people, Dodson and the youths, for working together to change the trajectory of their community. She said the youths, in particular, had a dream of going from seed to shelf by opening a community grocery store and providing much of the healthy produce that would be sold there. The dream came to fruition with a grand opening in 2021 of their market. They serve as an example and a reminder that each of us can make a difference in the lives of others, regardless of our age or circumstance, Campbell said of the group during an award ceremony on Wednesday in Oklahoma City. Dodson says she reminds herself that the young people have already done so much to serve their community, and they haven't even finished high school. The teens were modest about their achievements. Many of them said they were surprised to receive the award, but grateful and excited about the recognition. Those teens are Dwayne Amerson, Shylan Davis, Phoebe Deason, Bianca Eddings, Kenzel Hammond, Kaymonte Hammond, Anaya Johnson, Layla Johnson, Elijah Jones, Eric Jones, Markle Kendrick, Bailey Knight, Deanna Mason, Jada Roberts, Carson Veal, and Asa Williams. Friends Carson, Eric, and Elijah, who are homeschooled, said they had been Urban Farm interns with Restore OKC for about 4 years. Carson, a high school senior, said he connected with the nonprofit when he visited the organization's headquarters in former Northeast Oklahoma City Church and helped out with a community garden there. I was surprised and really excited. I knew helping out with the grocery store was a big deal, Carson says of receiving the Legacy Award. Twins Eric and Elijah, who are 17, are high school juniors. Eric said he was simply excited that all the interns were being recognized. Anaya, who's 15, a freshman at Dove Science Academy, said she wanted people to know that they could do anything if they put their mind to it. Meanwhile, several of the youth said the grocery store project was just the beginning. They have plenty of dreams and goals yet to be accomplished. Anaya said she and her sister Leela, a fellow intern, received a grant recently to beautify the landscaping at a park in their Creston Hills neighborhood. Kaymonte Hammond said he and his friend and fellow intern Eric each hope to attend culinary school and return to their community someday to open a restaurant. Erica Jones, the mother of Eric and Elijah Jones, said she doesn't doubt all of the students will accomplish whatever they set out to do. She said she's enjoyed seeing the young people recognized for their good deeds. I thought it was just an amazing opportunity to showcase the good things going on in Northeast Oklahoma City, she says. There are young people there that care, who want to work and invest in their communities. Shanta Veal, Carson Veal's mom, shared similar thoughts. The highlight for me was the word legacy, because normally you don't hear about starting a legacy at such a young age. They're able to see the impact that they have already had on their community. Hey there, folks. I hope you're enjoying the show. I want to remind you that we are a 100% listener-supported family of podcasts, all under the umbrella of the Heartland Pod. You can catch our flagship show, The Heartland Pod, on Mondays every week with Adam Summer, where he delivers an opening statement before being joined by Sean Diller and Rachel Parker for a talking politics session on the week that was and diving into elections, legislation, and public policy. You can also join Adam on most Tuesdays and Thursdays for Let's Have a Chat, featuring interviews with folks of interest from around the Midwest. On any given week, he could be chatting up a politician, farmer, scientist, you name it. On Wednesdays, the focus shifts to a rotating cast of special reports with The Delta from science teacher and author Nicholas Linke and High Country, Sean Diller's Western political updates. Learn more at heartlandpod.com, and don't forget, for full access to the Last Call episodes and the Heartland News blog, sign up on Patreon as a podhead today. And now, the lightning round. Pillen snatches victory over Trump pick in Nebraska gubernatorial primary. Jim Pillen has won the primary for the GOP nomination in Nebraska, beating out Trump-backed candidate Charles Herbster and Brett Lindstrom. Pillen, a businessman and University of Nebraska region, had the endorsement of the current governor, Pete Ricketts, and longtime Nebraska football coach Tom Osborne. Herbster's defeat is Trump's most significant endorsement loss since he left office and the first of 2022. Herbster had been accused of groping by multiple women, including two who have spoken out about their experiences openly. Pillen focused on unity and the future in his victory speech Tuesday night, saying, "We're going to focus on what's best for Nebraska. We're going to invest in farming so our kids all know the grass is greenest in Nebraska." He spoke out about a desire to focus on agriculture and education. Pillen goes on to face Democratic State Senator Carol Blood, who won her party's nomination Tuesday night. Parents' Bill of Rights constitutional amendment is stopped in the Missouri House. The House voted down an opportunity on Tuesday to allow voters to amend the Missouri Constitution to include a, quote, Parents' Bill of Rights. Educators and labor leaders voiced concerns about the bill in the Missouri legislature before the vote, saying that parents already have their rights when it comes to public school education, and warned that these measures might serve to only burden educators. The bill would have required written permission from parents for kids to attend school assemblies, field trips, and any other extracurricular activity, and allow them to object to classroom materials based on their beliefs, not educational facts. The bill outlined a set of rules that allowed the state to withhold funds if those rules were broken, yet another avenue to attack the funding of public schools. It also would have allowed parents or the attorney general to sue school districts. One lawmaker, Representative Marlene Terry, a Democrat out of St. Louis, put it succinctly, saying, "I haven't seen one parent come up here and complain about anything going on in their school system, especially where I'm from. I don't hear anybody in committee come up and complain about anything. This is something personal. In Ohio, pharmacy chains could pay $870 million for role in opioid epidemic. A lawyer for two Ohio counties said on Monday that CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart should fund an $878 million plan to address the opioid crisis there, as a first-of-its-kind trial got underway to determine the pharmacy chain's contribution. A federal jury decided in November, in the first trial the pharmacy chains faced over the crisis, that the companies created a public nuisance by flooding Ohio's Lake and Trumbull counties with addictive prescription pain pills that wound up on the black market. Now the counties want the companies to fund a $878 million 5-year plan that Mark Lanier, a lawyer representing the counties, said on Monday was aimed at solving the opioid crisis rather than allocating blame. Lanier's remarks came at the start of a 2-week trial before U.S. Judge Dan Pulser in Cleveland, who will decide how the companies should correct a public nuisance caused by the prescription opioids. CVS, Walgreens, and Walmart have denied the county's claims and said they would appeal the November verdict. Companies have offered to fund a 1-year program to buy back unused prescription opioid drugs in the two counties. They argue that Ohio's public nuisance law only requires them to stop the nuisance identified by the jury, an oversupply of prescription drugs, and not to address all of its harmful effects on the communities. The counties have argued that the illegal drug use must be addressed at the trial, since addictions caused by the oversupply of prescription drugs created a market for illicit drugs like heroin and synthetic fentanyl. The U.S. opioid epidemic has caused more than 500,000 overdose deaths over the last 2 decades. More than 3,300 opioid lawsuits have been filed nationally against drug makers, distributors, and pharmacy chains. Biden to announce steps to aid farmers and lower food costs in a trip to Illinois. President Joe Biden on Wednesday visited a family farm in Illinois to announce steps the administration is taking to lower the costs of farming and food. The COVID pandemic and Russia's invasion into Ukraine have contributed to supply chain disruptions, increasing food prices and shortages in the United States and abroad. A Putin's price hike, according to the president. Putin's unjustified invasion of Ukraine has cut off a critical source of wheat, corn, barley, oilseed, and cooking oil. It has also disrupted global supply chains for fertilizer, which farmers depend on to maximize yields. As a result of the pandemic and Russia's invasion, food prices have increased by nearly 13% around the world. Biden's trip to the Midwest comes as he tries to demonstrate that his administration is taking actions to bring down inflation, an issue Republicans have focused on in the midterm election campaigns. The president delivered a speech Tuesday about efforts to tamp down inflation, arguing that GOP lawmakers don't have a concrete plan to address the issue. During the farm visit, the president announced that his administration will expand insurance for double cropping, which allows farmers to plant a second crop on the same land in the same year, also announcing that the government will increase technical assistance to farmers and double funding for producing fertilizer domestically. Ranked choice voting submitted for Missouri ballot. Another measure seeks to be added to the Missouri ballot this fall, ranked choice voting. If passed, it would apply starting in 2024 to elections for statewide office, the Missouri General Assembly, and U.S. Congress. The Missouri system would put up to 4 candidates in a fall contest. If it was in place this year, for example, there would be 4 candidates advancing in the statewide contest for U.S. Senate, where 21 Republicans, 11 Democrats, and 1 Libertarian and 1 Constitutional Party have filed, and state auditor, where 4 candidates in total have filed. There are also at least 4 candidates in all 8 congressional districts, 6 of the 17 state Senate races, and 13 of the 163 Missouri House contests. Then, in the fall election, voters could give their vote to a single candidate, or they could then rank their choices among the candidates listed. And lastly, tired of waiting, mysterious person fills potholes on St. Louis Street. People are so frustrated with potholes in the St. Louis area roadways that they've started filling the potholes themselves. Thousands of potholes remain in the region, but you can now cross the monster pothole on Rosebery Avenue off the list. Residents said someone who lives in the area just west of Forest Park got tired of waiting on the City of St. Louis Streets Department and patched it themselves over Mother's Day weekend. The patch job included small tiles spelling out the words, "Eat the Rich," tapped into the asphalt. Nearby resident Chris Coos was just glad that someone finally filled the pothole after nearly a year. With street parking, there's no way to avoid hitting it. He says there are cars on both sides. If you don't want to hit them, but you also don't want to hit the pothole, it was a lose-lose situation. I'm not complaining about the pothole being filled. There's even a candidate for U.S. Senate from St. Louis running on a platform with one primary goal: filling every pothole in America. That candidate is C.W. Gardner, who states in a campaign video, "When I get to Washington, I plan on introducing my pot for potholes legislation. Tax revenue from federally legalized marijuana sales would pay for the program." People hate potholes so much that they're actually starting to take him seriously. Well, folks, that's all the time we have this week. I want to thank you for joining us. And if you have a story you think that I should look into and possibly highlight on the show, please tweet me throughout the week at KevInMidbow or the pod's parent account at The Heartland Pod. This week's episode featured reporting and information from CBS, Just the News, Nation, Reuters, the Missouri Independent, KSHB, and The Oklahoman. Thanks for listening.
The Flyover Review is a production of MidMap Media, LLC. Learn more at www.heartlandpod.com or at The Heartland Pod on Twitter. See y'all next week.